This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Two remarkable slave narratives recently surfaced and are collected in a new book. What makes them especially valuable is they tell the stories of the writer's escape from slavery during the Civil War. The book is called A Slave No More, Two Men Who Escaped to Freedom. It includes the narratives written by John Washington and Wallace Turnage. My guest, David Blight, is the director of Yale University's Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition. He edited the narratives and wrote an essay putting them in historical context. Less than 2 months ago, Blight and his researcher were able to track down some descendants of John Washington. We'll hear from three of them later in the show. They knew nothing of the narrative. They didn't even know John Washington had been a slave. David Blight, welcome to Fresh Air. Why are the two slave narratives that you've edited and included in your book, A Slave No More, why are they so important? What's their significance?
Well, they're important first because they are rare. They're extraordinarily rare. Before the Civil War, from the 1740s until about 1865, we have only about 65 such autobiographies by former slaves published in English. From the end of the Civil War up until the 1920s, when the last of slaves who wrote about themselves began to die off, we only have about 55 such documents published in English. But what makes these so unusual is that they were never published, they were never edited, they were never touched. They arrived in my lap as raw, unmediated documents. And in essence, these are two former slaves telling the story of how they escaped in the midst of the Civil War. And we have precious few of those as well, where a former slave tells largely the story of his emancipation.
I'm going to ask you to read an excerpt of John Washington's narrative, but before we do that, tell us a little bit about what his life as a slave was like.
In John Washington's case, he was born in 1838 in Fredericksburg, Virginia. His father was white, although if he ever knew who he was, he never told us. And in this case, I've never been able to determine exactly who Washington's father was, in part because there are so many Washingtons in the state of Virginia. But he grows up an urban slave, and that makes all the difference in the world. He was literate, skilled, intelligent, highly valued. He tells us that his own mother first taught him his letters and his alphabet, although he also had some other tutoring along the way. And furthermore, he was hired out several times, four times to be exact, in the late 1850s and up through 1861, hired out to a local tobacco factory, to a local family. He was hired out to a hotel. And in this hiring out process, he was also able to put up a little money of his own. A slave that was hired out brought home wages that the master kept. But if he worked extra hours, for example, at the tobacco factory, he was able to keep some of that. He was an urbane young man of 22 when he escaped from slavery. He also fell crazy in love with his basically childhood sweetheart, a young free black woman named Annie Gordon, whom he met at the African Baptist Church in Fredericksburg in the mid-1850s. One love letter, indeed, that he wrote to her survives, which is a rare such document written by a former slave, and even some fragments of a diary that he kept in the late 1850s have survived, and most of that diary is indeed the tale of his courtship of young Annie. So this is an unusual, fairly special, highly valued young slave, but a slave nonetheless.
Before you read the passage about getting his freedom, tell us what the earlier part of that day was like for him, the part of that day when he was still a slave.
It is the most dramatic moment in Washington's narrative. He has an encounter with his mistress, his owner, Mrs. Tolliver, who is packing everything up like all of the white population of Fredericksburg. They're evacuating town. And they have an exchange where she tells him, "Now, John, you'll be with us tomorrow. You'll be with us when we leave." And he says, "Yes, mistress, yes, mistress, I'll be there." But his next scene, in effect, is he's at the hotel where he's hired out. It's called the Shakespeare. And he's kind of an assistant manager there. The owner of the hotel values him so much that he gives him a wad of cash, of bills, to pay off all of the help, most of whom are slaves. And he describes how all the white guests and the white management are fleeing the hotel and running down the streets. Meanwhile, he takes all of the black helpers, about a dozen of them.
I should stop you and say they're fleeing because the Union soldiers are coming.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. The Union troops have just arrived across the Rappahannock River. And John takes the black workers up onto the roof of the hotel where they can see across the river to what he describes as the gleam of the Yankees' bayonets, and they can begin to hear the sound of the Union Army bands. Then he brings them down into the kitchen. He pours a round of drinks, and he holds a toast, and the toast is to the Yankees. And then he instructs his fellow workers to, in essence, get out of there, but as he says, don't get too far from the Yankees. Then John simply walks down to the river two blocks. He witnessed the surrender of the city of Fredericksburg. And then he walked about a mile with a cousin north and west upriver. And then he turned down to the river, he said, at Ficklin's Mill, and the ruins of that old mill are still there. So I know exactly where he crossed the river. And there he encountered Union troops on the other side of the river who yelled to him and sent over a rowboat. And John got in, crossed the river, and that night he slept in his first night of freedom amongst a regiment from New York State.
Why don't we hear some of the story in his words as he writes it? And why don't you pick it up with a part of the story where he's crossing the river to the other side?
Sure. Very soon one of a party of soldiers in a boat call out to the crowd standing around me, "Do any of you want to come over?" Everybody said, "No." I hollowed out, "Yes, I want to come over." "All right, bully for you," was the response, and they were soon over to our side. I greeted them gladly and stepped into their boat. As soon as James saw my determination to go, he joined me and the other young man who had come along with us. After we had landed on the other side, a large crowd of soldiers off duty gathered around us and asked all kinds of questions in reference to the whereabouts of the rebels. I had stuffed my pockets full of rebel newspapers, and I distributed them as far as they would go, greatly to the delight of the men. And by this act won their good opinions right away. I told them I was most happy to see them all, and I had been looking for them for a long time. "Just here," one of them asked me, "I guess you ain't a secesh." "Then me," said I, "know why colored people ain't secesh." "Why, you ain't a colored man, are you?" said he. "Yes, sir, I am," I replied, "and a slave all my life." All of them seemed utterly astonished. "Do you want to be free?" inquired one. "By all means," I answered. "Where's your master?" said another. "In the rebel navy," I said. "Well, you don't belong to anybody then," said several at once. "The District of Columbia is free now, emancipated 2 days ago." I did not know what to say, for I was dumb with joy and could thank God and laugh.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Blight. He's the author of A Slave No More, which includes two recently discovered slave narratives about their trip to freedom. And David Blight is also the director of Yale's Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition. Once John Washington crossed over to the other side of the Rappahannock River and met with the Union troops, did the Union troops expect him to fight with them?
Well, no, not in this case. This was too early in the war. This is April 1862. It's well before the Emancipation Proclamation and the official recruiting of black troops. It's even before the Second Confiscation Act passed Congress, which wasn't until July of that year, which did authorize at least the beginnings of the liberation of slaves. In this particular case, he was taken in by Union troops as a camp servant. And he spent the rest of that summer, all the way through August of 1862, with the Union Army. And eventually his principal job, although at times he worked even as a scout on horseback, but his principal job was that he was, by his account, the chief mess cook for a division commander in the Union Army named Rufus King. And he will serve in that capacity through the disastrous campaign of Second Manassas, which happened on the last 2 days of August in Northern Virginia, another retreat and defeat of the Union forces who went back into Washington, D.C. And it is on September 1st that John Washington dates his final entry into Washington, D.C. as a free man. Later that fall, he would get his wife, Annie, their newborn child, his mother, and his 68-year-old grandmother, whose name was Molly, out of Virginia with him, and they would all be living in Washington, D.C. by 1863. In some ways, John Washington's greatest achievement, other than his self-liberation, was to gather this family in some semblance of safety in Washington by 1863.
Now, you mentioned that shortly before he was liberated from slavery, he married a woman who was a free woman who he met at church. And I guess I found that kind of amazing. Yeah. I don't know of other relationships between a slave and a freed person, you know, a freed African-American during that period. Was that a fairly typical relationship? And were there, like, legal restrictions on such relationships?
There were legal restrictions, including in the state of Virginia, but they were not always enforced. And in urban slavery, this is why it made a good deal of difference that John grew up in a city. In urban slavery, these lines were blurred. He met Annie, as I said, at church. She was about 5 years younger. And he does have a line in the narrative where he says her parents did not want her to marry him. He doesn't precisely say why, but it may be because he was a slave. But it is not that uncommon for slaves and free blacks to mingle socially, to live in the same circles, to worship together in church. And indeed, Frederick Douglass himself ended up marrying a free black woman named Anna Murray, whom he had known in Baltimore before he escaped from slavery. It's actually a very similar story.
What kind of life was John Washington able to make for himself after his emancipation?
His life in Washington was very, very difficult at first. He describes at first living in the streets of Washington. His first known address in 1864 was on 17th Street, and that address is what is today Constitution Hall in Washington. It's only about two blocks south and west of the White House. He helped found the original Shiloh Baptist Church in Washington, along with about 400 other freedmen from Fredericksburg. And then after about 1865, he is listed in every city directory and census document I could find as a painter, a commercial painter, a house painter. Eventually on his obituary, he's listed as a retired sign painter. But he and Annie had five sons. They lived out most of the rest of their life in what today we call Foggy Bottom, which is that whole neighborhood west of the White House grounds, what is today the area of George Washington University. He was a member of two different Baptist churches. At one point, he was president of the District of Columbia Sunday School Union. And he clearly lived a very active church and civic life. I was able to find at least enough notices and information about that. But perhaps most importantly, they did have five sons, and a couple of whom achieved a remarkable education and lived on well into the middle of the 20th century.
My guest is historian David Blight. He edited the two slave narratives in the new book, A Slave No More, and he wrote the introductory essay. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is historian David Blight, director of Yale's Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition. He edited the two slave narratives in the new book, A Slave No More, and wrote the introductory essay. The narratives, by John Washington and Wallace Turnage, describe how they escaped slavery during the Civil War. Let's turn to the story of Wallace Turnage, the second of the two freed slaves who write about getting their freedom in these narratives that you've edited in your book, A Slave No More. And for a while, Wallace Turnage not only was a slave, he was a slave who worked in an auction house that sold slaves. And then Indeed. He was sold in that very same auction house. Tell us a little bit about his life as a slave before he was liberated.
Yes, well, Wallace Turnage's story is, if anything, more dramatic and certainly more brutal than John Washington's. Turnage was born on a small tobacco farm near Snow Hill, North Carolina, Greene County, North Carolina. He was born in 1846, so it makes him about 8 years older than Washington. He was sold at age 14 by his indebted owner to Richmond, Virginia. And he was purchased there by a slave trader, a professional trader named Hector Davis. And we know quite a bit about Hector Davis because he kept extraordinary records of his sales. He owned a two-story slave auction house in Richmond on Franklin Street. And Wallace's job, if you will, for the 6 months or so that he lived in Richmond in 1860 was organizing slave auctions. And then one day he's told, you're in the auction. And he was sold to an Alabama cotton planter whose name was Chalmers. And about 3 days later, he found himself on a large cotton operation near Pickensville, Alabama, which is in central west Alabama, right near the Mississippi border. I should add, too, that Turnage's father was also white, and he knew exactly who his father was. His father's name was Sylvester Brown Turnage, and he put his father's name on every document he signed the rest of his life. His father was actually the stepson of his owner, and it's not clear that Wallace ever knew this father. I did discover that his father left the county and moved away when Wallace was only 3 or 4 years old. Now, most of Turnage's narrative is largely the story of his 5 attempts to escape from slavery, most of them in the midst of the Civil War, the first 4 over into Mississippi and along the Ohio and Mobile Railway up into northern Mississippi, where in 1862 and 63 he was trying to get to the Union armies, which controlled the whole northern tier of Mississippi. And his owner kept retrieving him, kept coming after him. He would be captured over and over and over, although on his 4th attempt to escape, he was at large some 4.5 months, hiding in other slave cabins and in the countryside and in gullies and so forth.
So he had 4 failed attempts to run away. How did he succeed the 5th time?
His master finally fed up with him running away, took him to Mobile, Alabama, and sold him again. He was purchased by a merchant in Mobile. And one day after he crashed his master's carriage, he ran again down into the city, as he put it, and hid for about a week in the Creole and black community of Mobile. Captured again, he was taken to the slave jail of Mobile and whipped viciously with 30 lashes, and was after that beating and being told to simply walk home again that instead of going home, he simply walked out of Mobile. He walked right through the Confederate encampments and fortifications and was no doubt simply mistaken for yet another black campaign. And the rest of Wallace Turnage's narrative is the story of his 3-week journey down about 25 miles of the western shore of Mobile Bay through the snake and alligator infested swamps of the Fowl River estuary to where he finally gets into an old rowboat that the tide brought in out at the mouth of Mobile Bay, and in late August 1864, with a plank of wood, he rowed himself out into the ocean. And the narrative becomes very dramatic at that point. As he is about to be swamped by a wave, he says he hears the oars of another boat, and that boat was a Union gunboat with some Yankee sailors in it. He jumped into their boat, and as he jumped into their boat, he says the Yankee sailors were struck silent as they looked at him. And he was brought before a general who gave him 2 choices. One was to join a black regiment as a soldier. The other was to serve as a servant to a white officer. And Turnage chose the latter. And he then served out the war as the mess cook for a officer from a Maryland regiment named Junius Turner. And Turnage's narrative frustratingly ends when he's with this officer in a Maryland regiment as they take Mobile at the end of the war, and then they're guarding Confederate troops on the way to New Orleans. And then he ends with a somewhat spiritual ending of the narrative and simply puts the words, "the end." And you want to take him by the collar and shake him and say, "No, don't stop. What happened to you? Where are you?" But that's where his narrative ends.
David Blight edited the slave narratives in the new book, A Slave No More, and he wrote the introductory essay. Blight is the director of Yale's Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with David Blight. He edited two recently discovered slave narratives by John Washington and Wallace Turnage that describe their escapes from bondage during the Civil War. Blight also wrote the introductory essay. He's the director of Yale's Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition. When we left off, we were talking about Turnage's narrative. Turnage had tried to escape slavery several times. He succeeded the fifth time during the Civil War when he was picked up by a Union gunboat. I asked Blight to read the passage from Turnage's narrative in which he describes how it felt after he got on the boat and was free.
After pulling about half an hour, we arrived at the fort. After we arrived at the fort, the captain asked me no more questions at all. His men took me to their tents and gave me attention and all that I wanted, and I stayed on Fort Powell all night. The next morning I was up early and took a look at the rebels' country with a thankful heart, to think that I had made my escape with safety after such a long struggle, and had obtained that freedom which I desired so long. I now dreaded the gun and handcuffs and pistols no more, nor the blowing of horns and the running of hounds, nor the threats of death from the rebels' authority. I could now speak my opinion to men of all grades and colors, and no one to question my right to speak.
That's David Blight reading from the slave narrative of Wallace Turnage, one of two slave narratives included in David Blight's new book, A Slave No More. They're both narratives about escapes to freedom. So even though the narrative ends kind of prematurely before we really know what happened to him after the war, what have you learned about what happened to him after the war?
Well, by research in an array of documents, from city directories to the census to Freedmen's Bank records to church records and so forth, I've been able to locate him. He lived 3 years in Baltimore until 1868. He, at some point in that 3 years, went back to North Carolina and retrieved his mother and some of his siblings, and they all appear in New York City in a census in 1870. He lived out the rest of his life until 1916, either in Manhattan or across the river in Jersey City. And Wallace Turnage worked at every conceivable kind of common laborer's job. He was a night watchman, a drayman, a barkeeper. At one point he was listed as a general jobber, which is a guy who buys items on the street and tries to sell them to other people. But he also developed a family. He married three times. His first two wives died on him. And he had seven children, four of whom died in infancy. He also was about a 35-year member of the original Abyssinian Baptist Church. He was married there three times, and he would be buried from there. He also joined a black fraternal order called the Hamilton Lodge. And indeed, he is buried in the collective burial plot, along with his wives and some of his children, of that particular fraternal order in Cypress Hill Cemetery in Brooklyn, New York.
Wallace Turnage and John Washington, whose slave narratives you include in your book, A Slave No More, they were among the slaves who knew how to read and write. Having published their narratives, what strikes you most about their writing? And you say in the introduction mm-hmm. that you've tried to basically leave the writing as is so that we could see how they wrote it. So, like, stylistically and in terms of, like, their spelling, their use of language, mm-hmm. all of those things, what do you find mm-hmm. most interesting?
Well, for me, the most moving thing about working on this project was watching these two men struggle to write on the page. They will both write two or three perfect sentences in a row, and then the fourth one will fall apart grammatically. Their spelling is creative. Wallace Turnage never met a paragraph. His narrative is 120 pages of one paragraph. I did paragraph his in the editing process, but I left the language alone. And in both cases, you can actually, it's almost palpable, watching them struggle to tell this one story that they seem to believe anyone would ever care to read. As to exactly why they wrote them, I can only speculate. I know John Washington wrote his in 1873, which is the year his fifth and last son was born, and he had sons from age 1 to 11. He may have wanted those sons to know who he was and where he was from and where they were from. In Turnage's case, he doesn't date it, but I think he wrote it a bit later, probably in the 1880s, and he does tell us he wrote it at more than one sitting because writing was so difficult to him. And I don't know exactly why Turnage wrote. Again, it may have been for his children, but there is no evidence that either one of them ever tried to publish these manuscripts. But I think the beauty of the writing here is that it was never touched by anyone. If these had been submitted to publishers and to an editorial process and so forth, we'd be reading probably quite different documents today. They would have been asked to conform to certain kinds of conventions and certain kinds of formulas of the post-war slave narratives.
How did these slave narratives survive?
Oh, in the case of John Washington, it survived through his granddaughter, whose name was Evelyn Easterly. She was the daughter of Washington's youngest son. And she lived into the 1970s, and she gave it to a best friend, a woman named Alice Jackson Stewart, who worked on the document, indeed collected a number of other documents, for which I'm grateful. But she then became elderly and left it to her son, who is a man named Julian Houston, who lives in Boston today. Julian is a retired African-American judge in Boston. He then gave it to a literary agent who brought it to me and asked me to work with it. In the case of Turnage, it's even better. It survived through his daughter, who lived to be 99. Her name was Lydia Turnage Connolly. She married an Irish immigrant hotel worker in the 1940s and moved to Greenwich, Connecticut. And she died there in 1984 in a nursing home and left one box of material to a neighbor, a lady who is still alive. Her name is Gladys Watts. And Mrs. Watts sat on that box, so to speak, for 18 years until she watched a television documentary called Unchained Memories, which is about the WPA oral history narratives of the 1930s. And shortly after watching that film in early 2003, she called up the Greenwich Historical Society and said, "I may have something that will interest you." And they sent someone over and said, "Yes, ma'am, you do." I was then invited to give a lecture in Greenwich only about 5 months after the John Washington narrative had been given to me. And while I was there to give the lecture, the director of that historical society said, "My staff thinks we have an authentic slave narrative. Would you have a look at it?" And suddenly I had two of these documents lopped into my lap independently in essentially the same six-month period.
What did you learn from these two narratives of emancipation that you didn't know before?
I think the most important thing I learned from working with these two narratives is perhaps something that was confirmed for me. To the extent historians have had a major debate about the nature and meaning of emancipation over the past 20 years, that debate has been about essentially who freed the slaves. Did Lincoln and the armies free the slaves, or did the slaves free themselves? And in both of these cases, they provide us wonderful windows into the fact that the answer to that question is both. Without the Union Army and the Union Navy, neither man would have become free. But also without their own ingenuity and bravery and cunning, they would also have not become free either. What both of these narratives allow is a journey into that on-the-ground experience of emancipation in the chaos and the violence of the Civil War And in both cases, we can follow them as real people instead of that abstraction through which we often see emancipation, which is somehow droves of slaves journeying to their day of jubilee.
My guest is historian David Blight. He edited the two slave narratives in the new book, A Slave No More, and wrote the introductory essay. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is historian David Blight. He edited the two slave narratives in the new book, A Slave No More, and wrote the introductory essay. The narratives, by John Washington and Wallace Turnage, describe how they escaped slavery during the Civil War. If you could ask Washington or Turnage a question about their slavery or their emancipation, do you know what you'd want to ask them?
Yes. I would ask them more about their post-war lives. I would want to know, I would want to hear them try to discuss what it was really like to live in Washington, D.C. in the late 19th century, or to live in New York City in that section of lower Manhattan known as Little Africa by the 1890s, a section of about 2,000 African Americans, most of them former slaves, living in dire poverty, living under all kinds of brutal discriminations. I would want to hear them try to discuss what it was like to be part of that first generation of former slaves who made up the original black working class in northern industrial cities. That's the part of their experience that I was able to uncover pieces of, but not enough of. It's that part of their lives that I would just love to hear them tell me more about. I'd also like to hear them tell me more about their mothers, because both of them had extraordinary relationships with these two women, who in each case had taught them to read and write. And in both narratives, they describe a parting scene where they last saw their mothers, especially John Washington. But yet each of them later managed to reconvene with their mothers after the war. And they went to great extents to get their mothers out of the South with them. Wallace Turnage's mother, Courtney Hart, died on the west side of Manhattan in 1890, living in the 200 block of West 60th Street, right behind what is today Lincoln Center. And John Washington's mother, Sarah, lived out her life in Washington into the early 1880s and is buried in a cemetery in Georgetown. Both of them died on free soil, and I would love to hear John and Wallace try to discuss what that meant to them.
Well, we're about to speak to descendants of John Washington, one of the two ex-slaves who tells their emancipation story in your new book, A Slave No More, in which you've printed these two emancipation narratives. Tell us something about them and the significance of having descendants to talk with us about their lives.
Well, it has been a very special experience to discover Ruth Washington and Barbara Hinksman and Barbara's daughter, Maureen. I only met them about 5 weeks ago in October of this fall. It took a long time to find them. We actually found them through an obituary in a New Jersey newspaper, and we located Ruth. This is John Washington's granddaughter, age 89, living in Tampa, Florida, and her niece, Barbara. I think the most extraordinary thing about this has been that Ruth, as John Washington's granddaughter, knew almost nothing about her grandfather. He died the year she was born, and her father, John Jr., died when she was only 18 and a freshman at Hampton University. But she never even knew she had roots in Virginia. She had been cut off from that part of her family, and indeed, therefore, cut off from her slave ancestry. But she did possess one photograph that she showed me. It's a photograph of John and Annie Washington's gravestone up in Massachusetts where they're born. But she couldn't read the names on them, and she said she'd always been told that was her grandparents' gravestone, but she never knew who they were or where it was. So I look forward to the day of hopefully taking Ruth Washington up to Cohasset, Massachusetts, and showing her her grandparents' gravestone.
Well, I think we'll let Barbara and Ruth take the story from there. David Blight, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on, Terry.
David Blight edited the slave narratives of John Washington and Wallace Turnage, which are included in the new book, A Slave No More. Blight also wrote the introductory essay.